A warning to listeners or readers. The following content may at times include details about abuse, rape, suicide, domestic violence, and other types of trauma that may be emotionally confronting or triggering.
Welcome to Raised by an Invisible Village, where we unbundle the incredible power of the people who influence our lives. I'm Kathy Houlihan, your host, who will be guiding you on a very personal transformative journey. My personal story of uncovering the diverse characters that made up my invisible village, who together enabled acceptance, growth, and success. Before I take you into the next phase of my journey in life, this week I was overwhelmingly reminded of my purpose for telling you my story. 6 weeks ago, I decided that it would be important to access my childhood records from FOI, Freedom of Information. It hasn't been an easy task as my history incorporates three different government departments: the Attorney General Justice Office, police, and Territory Families. Territory Families initially came back to me really quickly, having found no records at all, which was so strange given the enormity of events that occurred from the age of 12 to 18. From there, I was directed to the National Archives, and a lovely lady has been helping me navigate the complex filing storage system. After all, we are trying to find records from decades ago. This is a work in progress, and I'm sure there'll be some more about this in a future episode about what was actually found. I'm still waiting on the police records to get back to me, but the Attorney General Justice Office did locate documents, and within a few days, I literally had two separate documents detailing the transcripts from the judge's sentencing of those sexual assaults in February 1986. To say it was incredibly confronting is an understatement. To be honest, I wasn't really sure what to expect, and then for my husband, my partner in life, Joe, to read them as well was quite overwhelming. For the first few days, I found myself a little dazed, not really knowing how I was feeling, not really knowing how to talk about it. Joe also not really knowing what to say or do. The uncomfortable conversation and the raw reality of how horrific that night had been. The undeniable trauma and recalling of memories buried so deep in my inner soul that had been almost locked in a time capsule for decades. It is truly remarkable how the body and mind work to protect us, particularly when something is so traumatic. Locking it down until we are ready to let it out. Connect and heal. It was one of those moments, be careful what you ask for. It may just not be really what you want to hear, see, or read. But I was ready. My mind and body was ready to connect, heal, and finally let go. It was several days after reading the documents that the anxiety racing in my heart started to settle. An outer body sensation and the awful feeling in your body of embarrassment, shame, and humiliation slowly bubbling to the surface. The realization that it wasn't just me that was trying to make sense of how I was feeling, it was also now impacting Joe. Struggling to find the right words to make it okay, when none of what I had was okay. Not for me, not for my auntie, and not for anyone else that was in that courtroom, and not for Joe. And then finally the tears came. Those type of tears that come from somewhere so deep in your belly they just can't be stopped. Joe and I cried together, we shared our innermost deep feelings and connected in a safe space that allowed me to let go. Forgiveness to grieve for a day, entitled to cry and feel sorry for myself for just a moment in time. It was a powerful reminder of why I'm telling my story, the core being of how we can overcome dysfunctionality and dig deep into our invisible village and recognize those amazing characters who are there when we need them. And when we really, really look, there are so many. That night in February 1986, I could have been thrown over that old railway bridge, or I could have been locked up in that man's cabin. No one would have known for days or maybe weeks that I was missing. The fact that I'm here to tell my story is a responsibility I feel the need to share what I have come to believe. Why am I okay? Why did I survive? Why is my life so incredible? I know for most people hearing this part of my story, the horrific events of those sexual assaults will be creating high levels of uncomfortableness, perhaps even anxiety, and I certainly encourage you to speak to someone if you are feeling any of those things. Only 30% of sexual assaults are reported, and 1 out of 5 women are said to have experienced a sexual assault or abuse. And for males, these stats are almost identical. This means either you or someone you know has experienced abuse. We need to be talking about it and being comfortable with uncomfortable. What I have come to believe, that trauma creates more trauma, creating layers of dysfunctionality that compounds week after week, month after month, and then years after years. Memories of deep inner trauma become consumed and covered up by more trauma. That survival is all you know. Like a callus on your foot or hand, sometimes it hurts, but the skin grows over and it hardens the layers below. Until that moment, you stop and remove the agitation, allowing healing to come into our space and soften. And so for me, my incredible reminder that I am not being sexually assaulted now. I have many, many amazing characters in my invisible village, and the one that is with me 24/7 right now, my husband. Nurturing, respectful, understanding, and not trying to fix it. Letting the conversation settle between us both. And it is no coincidence that as I am putting this episode together, that the sound of the kookaburra has suddenly arrived back. Not just one, but 4. The instant connection that profound healing is taking place, right now in this moment of time. Peace has come over me again, and I am ready to bring you into the next phase of my story. After the sad departure of Sheila and Wayne, we were introduced to 2 new house parents at Matthew Cottage. They were English and had with them 2 little boys who were about 18 months and 3 years of age. The dynamic they brought to Matthew Cottage was completely different to what we had previously experienced. They were strict, and given their English ways, meant a lot of change for us. It actually astounds me that they were employed with allowing their own children to live in a house that was filled with other children at risk. My role in the house was instantly disrupted. As I had previously with Sheila, I was no longer allowed to cook meals or be involved with looking after the babies and toddlers that came into the house. The value and acceptance that we all had been given previously was no longer there. The girls in the house that had previously been allowed to speak language were not able to. The mashed potato and tomato sauce was banned from the dining table, and the youngest I remember on one occasion being forced to eat peas that she almost immediately vomited up, and the aggression that followed. For me personally, they were trying to instigate a reconciliation with my parents. There seemed to be little recognition of the reasons that I'd come to be in Matthew Cottage. I vaguely recall a few conversations that these house parents were having with my parents without my knowledge, and then trying to facilitate almost like a mediation session between us. I don't remember the exact conversation, I just remember the feeling of, here we go again. These people had no understanding that my return back into the family home was returning me back to a religion that I wanted no part of. I'd returned to complete isolation, and what I've finally come to know as a mental abuse. It was also during this time that it was made clear to all of us girls that we were not to contact Sheila and Wayne, which in our minds was just ridiculous. I am sure that for our new house parents, the love we all had for Sheila and Wayne was just too competitive. They couldn't get the same level of respect from us. The memories of my time with our new house parents were almost a revert back to chaos. I remember having lots of tears and fights, particularly with the house dad. He tried to impose this power and control over me. He couldn't understand why I wasn't living with my parents, and a standout statement from him at one point in time being, if I ever had children, that they would be put into care, and so the cycle continues. This statement has stayed with me always, and there was no way that if I was ever gifted to have children, that they would ever be put into care. I was not my parents. It was several months of all this change in the house that we were all told that we'd be going on a holiday to the Gold Coast. Somehow they had managed to find the funds to fly us all over for the Christmas holidays. This was going to be our Christmas present. We were all so excited. The girls had never been on a plane before, let alone the glitz and glamour of the Gold Coast, nor seen or been on a beach. Our arrival onto the Gold Coast, and again we would have turned a lot of heads with our dynamic. English adults with English accents, two white toddlers, four Aboriginal girls, and then me, blonde, white-skinned girl. A high-rise hotel had been booked, the younger girls all sharing adjoining rooms with their house parents, and myself and older foster sister sharing a separate room. The hotel was across from the beach, the sound of the ocean could be heard, and that salty smell just stunning. It was a long way from our welfare house at Matthew Cottage in Alice Springs. Our holiday together, though, was absolutely miserable. I remember being in tears a lot. My house dad always seemed to make me wrong about something. The other girls mesmerised by the TV and happy just to stay inside. Our house parents being quite annoyed and angry that they'd brought us all the way to the Gold Coast and the girls not interested in the white sand and surf. Considering that Alice Springs only had one TV channel, being ABC, and all the stations that they had access to now, was such a novelty. There was absolutely no insight from the house parents that the girls were also from the red dust and waterholes, and the beach was actually a really scary place. Christmas Day came while we were on the Gold Coast. No gifts though, as our holiday was our gift, but we all wanted to speak to Sheila and Wayne. I'd organised flowers to be sent to them and I arranged for all us girls to go down to the phone box to talk to them. Well, that didn't go down well. When our house parents found out and I got myself into a whole lot of trouble again. Our arrival back to Alice Springs from our holiday was a bit of a blur. The tears, sadness and missing Sheila and Wayne was terrible. For me, it was like going through all of that trauma, being back at home with my parents all over again. Our house parents' continued rants with why I should be living back at home, my parents, was incredibly dominating. It wasn't long after we had returned from our holiday and it was announced to all of us girls that welfare were going to be finding foster homes for us, external from Matthew Cottage. In a way, I felt relieved that I was going to be getting away from these house parents, but so sad that all of us girls were going to be separated. And so it was, I was relocated to a white foster family. The dad worked in the railways and the mother was a stay-at-home mum with a little baby. The house they lived in was a little old railway cottage, located close to town and in the middle of the Alice Springs rail yards. My room was a side sleep-out that had been enclosed. They had previously fostered other children before me, but I was their first female teenager. The first few months seemed to be quite amicable. I don't remember it being awful. It just wasn't the same as being in Matthew Cottage with Sheila and Wayne. I hadn't seen the other girls since leaving and I had no idea what had happened to them. And as for my parents, I don't remember seeing or hearing from them since the unsuccessful reconciliation attempts by the new house parents of Matthew Cottage. This was the start of 1988 and I was now in Year 11 at the Saturdeen Secondary College, as it was called back then. Year 11 and 12 were split from all the other high schools around Alice Springs for some reason, but it meant that there was a wider group of friends. And like most teenagers that age, the segregation between different schoolyard groups had started to occur, from those that were actually wanting to do well to those that were just muddling their way through. Well, I was one of those that was muddling her way through. I'd finally had a maths teacher who helped me make sense of formulas, but an English still remained my favourite and were my best marks. We were also starting to map out our careers and planning what we wanted to do post-high school. I decided that I was going to be a midwife, and that way I could go out to all the remote communities. The core subjects of biology and science were really difficult for me, and getting a grade beyond a C was not going to happen. The friendship groups that we had before Saturdeen were shifting. My closest friend Sophia had left school, however, it started to form a close relationship with Nikki, another character in my invisible village. She had a very similar background to me. The eldest child of a large family, very religious parents, had become rebellious and was sent to live with her auntie in Alice Springs, away from a very small town in country New South Wales. My boyfriend that I'd had during year 9 and 10 had moved on with someone else, and I remember at the time being devastated. School, that had always been my safe place, was starting to break down. I can't remember exactly the moments that triggered my next suicide attempt, but I do remember that I specifically went to the doctor to ask for painkillers, pretending that my periods were really heavy and painful. I later took a whole bottle, and then I remember waking up in the emergency department of Alice Springs Hospital vomiting. There were all these heart monitors on me and nurses and doctors, and it wasn't long before I was taken up to the ICU ward for monitoring. I don't know how long I was in there, but there seemed to be a flurry of psychologists and other medical staff attending to me. After I'd been released from hospital and back with my foster parents, who basically informed me that I should be lucky that I was still allowed to live with them. Apparently, if it had been anyone else, they'd have let them go. Not sure where I would have gone, but nevertheless, they kept me. My parents, who I distinctly remember having had next to no communication with me, turned up at our house within several days of being out of hospital. The foster parents somehow must have arranged it as they quickly disappeared. Into the house my parents walked, sit down at the little dining table that was in the kitchen, my father trying to touch my hand and me trying to make sense of why they had even bothered. So angry with them that it took a serious suicide attempt for them to come and see me. For several Sundays after this event, my father would come and sit with me, and just for a moment in time, there seemed to be a small reconciliation of mending a very broken relationship. Again, my mind is a mishmash of memories that are all blurred together. The first 6 or so months of year 11 were filled with drama, dysfunctionality, and chaos. I still had my job at Blue Cottage, which I continued to ride out to even after big nights of staying out with my friends. We were now drinking alcohol and taking drugs. Fortunately, it was only pot, but it was pretty regular by now. Staying out all night, going to different houses, going to nightclubs. I was only 15. Drinking in parks, walking the streets, going to speedways in the boot of cars. All risky behaviour at that very young age. Into the second semester of year 11, the foster parents I had been living with moved to another house that was completely on the other side of town. This meant that it was now way too far for me to ride my bike to work, and I had to resign. Now I was totally removed from everything that had been my safety net. The visits from my father had stopped, and something must have been triggered. Not sure what, but I do recall several letters from my mother. Not sure of the content, but I do remember the feeling. Again, their biblical justifications of terminating communication. Something that has been the yo-yo of the entire relationship with my parents, even up until a few years ago. Being dragged in and then spat out again. As I had done for most years, I would send them a copy of my school report, along with a school photo. This time, though, the envelope that I had my report card in had not been opened and scrawled across the front in my mother's handwriting the words, "Return to sender, not known at this address." It is insanely indescribable that any attempt of any reconciliation was always abruptly terminated by my parents. It was around this time that my uncle, my mother's brother, and his wife came to visit. They had travelled from New South Wales, Newcastle, to Alice Springs. I'm sure visiting me would have been extremely uncomfortable for them, but they were kind, although they too were Jehovah's Witnesses. I remember my uncle describing my father as one of the most humblest men that he had ever known, and me completely dumbfounded by such a ridiculous statement. For me, this had never been my experience, far from it. Not really sure of their intention of their visit, but I do recall being incredibly grateful that they, as Jehovah's Witnesses, had taken the time to visit me. My parents literally had wanted nothing to do with me at all. Even on one occasion, walking down the street with my friend Sophia, mother walking towards us, and upon seeing me, crossed the road onto the other side so as not have to talk to me. Sophia recalled this moment with tears in her eyes when we caught up a few months ago. So sad when you think about how stupid it all was and continues to be. It wasn't long after my uncle and auntie's visit that Nikki, my new friend at school, was going back home to her parents in New South Wales. I had become so far behind in my assignments at school, and without a job and no money to do the things I wanted to do, I decided to leave school. Life in the foster home had also done its time. I don't recall anything significant happening, but it just was not like anything we had experienced at Matthew Cottage. So with that, I applied for a job at Woolworths, and I was successful. It started out as a casual to begin with, and then once I officially had left school, I became full-time. Packing shelves and progressively being trained in the cash registers. Not like the scanning of the groceries today, it was the old-fashioned push-button register with the pricing stamps on the items. And like a true Kathy style, always wanting to be the quickest, it wasn't long before I was promoted to the express checkout line, the smoke counter. So funny when I think about that, promoted to the cigarette counter. It didn't come with a pay rise, it just meant I was fast. My 16th birthday was fast approaching, and I knew that this meant that although being a ward of the state until I was 18, I could now have a say in where I lived. I remember looking at a few share house options, but for some reason these scared me. So I settled into taking a room at the backpackers, Malanka Lodge. It's no longer in Alice Springs, but it was a pretty big backpackers, almost in the middle of town. It was a room in a dormitory-style wing, shared bathrooms with other people that were also staying there. My room faced the main road into town, which was really handy, as being close to the centre of town, my friends would jump through the window into my room without having to walk all the way round the backpackers. So with my wage of $150 a week, I would pay $100 for my board, and the remainder of my budget would be for cigarettes, packs of noodles, alcohol and pot. My new independent life was definitely a period of time of extreme risky behaviour. Most weekends would be spent drinking, smoking pot, driving around town with very little care of who was driving or what they'd been taking. Promiscuous behaviour of having multiple one-night stands, just muddling my way through that overwhelming desire to be loved but never finding it. My friend Sophia had come back to town, and while I remember it was so good to have her back in my life, our two worlds were moving in different directions. She had a boyfriend, and her nights out had been restricted by her auntie. That Christmas, which was only a few weeks after my birthday, that particular year was exceptionally lonely. Everyone had their own families, and my world was just me. My little wage of $150 only got me so far, and it felt like even welfare had abandoned me. All the welfare officers that I had known during my time in Matthew Cottage were all gone. I hadn't received any visits from anyone while I was in foster care. I'm not even sure if welfare knew that I was living in a backpacker's hostel. Not that I really cared. Not having to live at Matthew Cottage, that foster home, or with my parents, the hostel seemed to be the most logical solution. And then, what next happened? I was hanging out in the park with a few of my friends when I was introduced to one of the guys who I immediately became infatuated with. He was from Perth, very good looking, a footy player and a boxer. He had come over from Perth to live with his grandmother. We became really good friends within a short period of time. He wasn't like the other guys. He was kind and listened, and we would spend hours just talking. Until that day at the end of January 89, he told me that he had to go back to Perth, and he asked me to go with him. And oh my God, I was so excited, and I remembered thinking, how can I afford that? And he said, don't worry, we will work out a way. I'll call you when I get back to Perth. And I waited, and I waited, until he finally called. Now remember, we didn't have mobile phones back then, so I was reliant on him calling the public phone at Malanka Lodge. The day when he finally called, and he said, come on over, I was beyond excited. I was escaping Alice Springs and all that it represented. So with that and the help of Sophia, we planned my escape. Being a ward of the state, I wasn't meant to leave the Northern Territory until I was 18, but I didn't care. After all, welfare hadn't been close to checking in on me, let alone providing any emotional, physical, or financial support. With the help of Sophia, we packed all my belongings, stored them in a box at her auntie's place in a cupboard, resigned from my job at Woolworths, gave notice to Malanka Lodge, and caught a taxi to the Alice Springs Airport. My next adventure and phase of life was about to begin. In closing out this episode, I am almost sure, like it has for me, taken you on a roller coaster of emotions. Taking you through what was happening for me right now as I recorded this was almost as important as taking you through the what next events of the past. Keeping it real, raw, and authentic means that for all of us, past experiences will bubble back up from time to time. Understanding what's happening and all those triggers that take us back to that place. The recognition to allow healing to flow. A moment or moments to be connected with that feeling. For me personally, this episode reinvigorated me to be connected back to my purpose of sharing my story. Proving that dysfunctionality does not have to be permanent. The strength that we can gather from our invisible village comes to us in so many different ways, like soothing hands reaching out to lift us back up, enabling us to get to the next phase of whatever path our lives are on. Thank you for listening to this episode, Raised by an Invisible Village. I invite and welcome you into the next episode of my story, creating a safe and connected space for you and I.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the series Raised by an Invisible Village, and these real life stories have provided you with the opportunity to reflect about your own invisible village, a moment in time to uncover those who accept you, support your growth, and celebrate your success, and the recognition that you also are a character in someone else's invisible village, and how important our roles are as mentors, influencers, and champions. I'd love to stay connected and encourage you and others to join me by subscribing to my podcast channels. Together, we can continue to recognize the power of our invisible village for acceptance, growth, and success.